When someone says, I don't know much about art, but I know what I like, part of me wants to say, good for you. Go with that. Embrace it. Embrace your ignorance. And let it be a passport to fresh ideas, fresh feelings, and a weapon against received wisdom and cant. That's certainly how many modern artists have thought of the condition of not knowing.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum, discussing Learning to Look with Sebastian Smee. I'm Paul Tucker, and I'm an art historian and curator. I've had the great privilege of organizing a variety of exhibitions around the world, mostly on Impressionism and particularly on Mr. Monet. Our conversation this evening will explore the ways in which we have analyzed and come to understand works of art. Although Sebastian is a critic, and I am a historian, we actually, over all of our years, have shared very similar interests and concerns about critical issues, and particularly the issues of meaning, the meaning of a work of art, the meaning of that work to the viewer, the meaning to the artists, and ultimately, in the end, the meaning in terms of history. Sebastian Smee is the art critic of the Boston Globe. He won the 2011 Pulitzer Prize in Criticism for what the Pulitzer Committee called his, quote, vivid and exuberant writing about art. Sebastian has written a book on the relationship between Matisse and Picasso, and his weekly, quote, frame by frame articles focusing on individual works, organizations, and events in the New England art world have become truly must-reads items in the Boston Globe. Welcome to Cambridge Forum, Sebastian Smee.
There's a sentence, it's a sort of cliche that you've probably all heard before, and which I personally run into a lot. It comes up often when I'm in conversation with someone who asks me what I do for a living. When I reply, always admittedly with some embarrassment that I'm an art critic, it's often only a matter of moments before I hear something along the lines of, I don't know much about art, but I know what I like. Usually, of course, it's said with a little glimmer of irony, which I enjoy. But I find that there's something strangely passive-aggressive, too, about the impulse to say it in the first place. And so I've often wondered what it means and what it might indicate. On the one hand, it sounds like an expression of a certain kind of insecurity. And that makes sense. For many people who don't know much about it or who have had little exposure to it, art can seem daunting. Stories about it, too, can be dismaying. The idea, for instance, that someone could be willing and able to fork out $150 million for a single painting is inherently obnoxious. And many other aspects of art can also seem annoyingly infantile or unbearably pretentious. So that insecurity that is born of not knowing can easily turn into a kind of contempt. Mind you, art is hardly the only field which can seem hard for outsiders to understand. Talk to me about investment banking or theoretical physics or gardening, and pretty quickly, I'm at a loss too. Even though in truth, I would very much like to know a lot more. Art is actually a pretty basic subject compared to those others, and in many ways, it's a lot more approachable. Museums are everywhere, especially in this part of the world, and they're easily accessible. There's plenty of chatter about art in newspapers and magazines and online. So why does art attract this strange reaction, this reaction that, even as it owns up to ignorance, seems to sweep aside the idea that expertise would be of any value in the first place? It may seem perverse or counterintuitive or a bit of a stretch, but I see the reaction as in some ways a fascinating byproduct of the enormous influence of modern and contemporary art on our culture over the past 150 years or so. After all, in earlier art, talent and skill were always intimately connected to aesthetic worth and easy for all to see. Even today, everyone can appreciate the skills of a Michelangelo or a Titian, and no one's really going to take issue with the idea that these artists did what they were trying to do with unprecedented skill. But the claims made on behalf of a scrappy-looking painting by Cy Twombly, or a video by Matthew Barney, or even a colored paper cutout by Matisse, not to mention the prices these works fetch, can often seem so extravagant that when measured against the work itself, they inevitably come up short and ultimately may trigger dismay. And with that dismay, as I said, comes a certain defensiveness or even hostility. I get it. And I'm not surprised when I sense that defensiveness, that hostility, that scorn. When I'm thinking about this tension between expertise and ignorance, between professionalism and naivety, I always like to remember something that was said by the late British painter Lucian Freud. When you find something very moving, he said, you almost want to know less about it. It's a bit like when falling in love, you don't want to meet the parents. I like this idea, and it leads me to think that ignorance, although it's usually defined negatively, and for good reason, can also describe something more positive, a state of receptiveness, unobstructed by prejudice or by partial second-hand knowledge or by outdated ways of seeing. That's to say, ignorance or operating in the dark can actually be tremendously generative. As a form of not knowing, it's linked to curiosity, to thought experiment, to desire. And it's definitely linked to art. I think we've all probably had the experience in an art gallery of being surprised and extremely affected by something and not wanting to know more, not wanting to have a curator or a critic or a wall label get between us and the experience we're having. I happen to believe this feeling is an extremely precious one. And I think if we're all going to talk about art, we need to try to find ways to protect the possibility of succumbing to it. I also believe that possibility, even more than the opportunity to educate or enlighten or somehow to edify or civilize, is really the prime reason, certainly not the only reason, but one of the prime reasons that museums of art exist. But it's a possibility that's under attack. We've reached a point in our culture where theories and critiques have become so dominant that the primary encounter between an individual and a work of art is no longer regarded as sacred or even particularly valuable in many cases. The problem has become endemic. Concerted attempts to mediate experience through wall labels, through acoustic guides, exhibition design, and even museum architecture are everywhere, and they're often all but unavoidable. It's as if people need someone else's interpretation just to form a relationship with a work of art. Now, of course, I don't believe there's ever any such thing as a pure, unmediated experience of art. We're all affected by our moods, by worries about getting parking tickets, and of course, by whatever we may already know or think we know about Warhol or Monet or Dale Chihuly. And that's entirely natural. But we do, despite these factors, still have the ability to think for ourselves when we're called upon. And I'm inclined to think that a lot of the time we don't make the most of it. As an art critic working for a daily newspaper, I'm obliged to share facts and information that I find relevant and interesting. And I love doing that. But I don't actually believe my role in the final analysis is to educate people about art. That's better left to people more qualified, like Paul and many others. Rather, it's to make critical judgments, to encourage debate, and hopefully to convey a certain amount of passion and enthusiasm for the subject. So when someone says, I don't know much about art, but I know what I like, part of me wants to say, good for you. Go with that. Embrace it. Embrace your ignorance. Use it. And let it be a passport to fresh ideas, fresh feelings, and a weapon against received wisdom and cant. That's certainly how many modern artists have thought of the condition of not knowing. The painter Francis Bacon, for instance, said that whenever anything does work, in my case, it works from that moment when consciously I don't know what I'm doing. A huge number of great modern artists, when asked to describe the creative process, have expressed a similar sentiment. So maybe it's the same for looking at art. As I said, I think the not knowing much about art but knowing what one likes cliché is more than just an expression of insecurity or hostility. I think it's also at times an expression of something that's very dear and very important to art, and perhaps especially to modern art. Ever since about the 1850s and 60s, when inherited criteria for what constituted a good painting began to break down under the influence of rapidly changing social conditions, and of course the innovations of artists like Courbet, then Manet and the Impressionists, and then Matisse and Picasso, and Kandinsky and Mondrian and Duchamp and so on and so on. All through this period, And right up to today, really, the very idea of expertise in art, of exercising judgment according to a received set of criteria, has repeatedly been turned upside down and inside out. And of course, among many other effects, this has put art critics in an invidious position. But what began to count far more than expertise or skill was a sensibility, a way of looking at things, backed by a set of ideas that were often nebulous, but always in pointed opposition to conventional notions of quality. And so the idea that there was merit in coming at the tradition of art from different angles, from, say, a nonchalant and playful perspective, as in the case of Manet, or a childlike perspective, as in the case of Matisse, or a utopian perspective, in the case of Mondrian or Malevich, or from an irrational perspective, in the case of Dada, or even from an uninformed and untrained perspective, in the case of Dubuffet and Miró and de Kooning and countless others. All this gained great traction. Indeed, the story of modern art is, in many ways, the story of how these different, oblique, and novel approaches were variously adopted, one after the other, and transformed into great works of art, and into a climate of critical reception. I'm putting it all extremely crudely, of course. It's not as if the idea of skill or expertise disappeared entirely. But I'm trying to make the point that not knowing much about art, but knowing what you like, although it sounds philistine and insulting to people who have spent their lives studying or practicing art, can also be seen as just another expression of this ongoing resistance to received wisdom and to the dominance of official culture and of the thirst for new and immediate experience. I think this is good to be aware of, but in emphasizing it, I would sound just one note of caution. I would say this. I would say that when it comes to art, don't let ignorance, don't let not knowing be a kind of chastity belt, a symbol of prideful renunciation. Don't let it cordon you off from experience. Because in the end, quite obviously, knowing a few things, just a few handy things, and eventually maybe a lot of things, can actually open up whole new worlds of mysterious and transforming experience. You may know what you like, but if you don't remain open to the possibility that you may like many things you don't yet know of, you are being your own worst enemy. So what I want to protect, I suppose, is that feeling of susceptibility, both in myself and in anyone who happens to read my reviews. There are times when certain kinds of information conveyed in certain ways can enhance that feeling of susceptibility. And that's what I'm always trying to do. But there are other times when it gets in the way, when it's too much like getting to know the parents, a duty, a chore, a kind of a wet blanket. I do, as I said, believe that the more you know, the more your experience of art can deepen. But in the end, when I'm standing in front of a great portrait by Van Gogh or a still life by Chardin or an etching by Rembrandt, what I do or don't know is no longer really the point. I was reflecting on all this recently when writing about a favorite picture of mine, a picture that Degas painted in the late 1860s. Unfortunately, it's not in Boston. I had to go all the way to the Japanese island of Kyushu to see it. And I was lucky to do so just last year. But it's a very mysterious painting, and it's congested with unknowns. The more I found out about this painting, the more it intrigued me. But when I went to Japan and actually stood in front of it, I was moved by it in a way that really had very little to do with everything I had in the meantime learned. The picture remained as mysterious and as fundamentally unknowable as ever. The painting I'm talking about shows Degas' friend Manet leaning back on a couch and listening to his wife, Suzanne, playing the piano. What's strange about it is that when you get close, you see that a section of it, between about a quarter and a third of it, is missing. It's been replaced by an empty section of canvas, which has Degas' signature at the bottom. Now, the 1860s was a long time ago, but it was a decade in which one of the dynamics that ended up being central to modernism, a dynamic which in a way is connected to what I've been talking about, began to establish itself in art. I'm talking specifically about a tension between an idea of life as a knowable phenomenon and an idea of life as an unknowable phenomenon. A tension, that's to say, between 19th century positivism and the whole Enlightenment tradition on the one hand, and on the other, a developing reaction against this tradition, an insistence in the face of onrushing modernity that life should remain mysterious, enchanted, and unknowable. By the 1880s, this dynamic was making itself felt as a tussle between, and again, I'm putting things very crudely, and I feel embarrassed even saying this in front of Paul, but a tussle between the naturalism of the Impressionists, who tried to depict the actual conditions of colored light and the real appearance of things, and the symbolist-inspired, often Arcadian reveries of post-Impressionists like Gauguin, who tried to paint a dream world of suggestion and poetry. But this dynamic was already there in the 1860s, and you see it subtly, I think, in the rivalry between Degas and Manet. I think of Degas, at least in the 1860s, as the positivist, wedded to an idea of truth as knowable. He once said that one has to commit a painting in the same way that one commits a crime. But in a way, he was more like the detective who comes along after the crime, always looking for clues. Degas had met Manet earlier in the decade, in 1861, and Manet had inspired him to revamp his whole aesthetic, to address contemporary life, and to make himself, despite his classical academic training, truly modern. But even under Manet's influence, Degas held on to a different idea of what being modern entailed. He had an idea that portraiture, in particular, could reveal truths about individuals, and indeed about society, that even novelists would struggle to express. He'd become friends around 1865 with the writer Edmond Duranty, who discussed with Degas the idea that facial expression, in particular, could reveal a great deal about psychology. And from Degas' diaries and notes, we know that he was very taken with the idea that in his portraits, by attending carefully to facial expression and bodily gestures, he could pin down character. Manet? Less so. In the 1860s, Manet was still very much under the influence of his friend Baudelaire. The poet and critic had died in 1867. Manet was fundamentally allergic to the idea of hidden, knowable truths. He had secrets and he liked to keep them. He was in love instead with the surface of things, the dance of appearances. His paintings of the 1860s are filled with masks, costumes, and other disguises, a constant game of charades. His most famous models were almost always expressionless. So, given all this, it's interesting, surely, that the part of Degas' double portrait of Manet and his wife, Suzanne, that is missing is Suzanne's face. What happened? What happened is that Degas gave the finished picture to Manet in exchange for Manet's still life of plums. Sometime later, we don't know how long, Degas visited Manet's studio and saw that his picture had been slashed with a knife. Manet, it seems, had, for some reason, taken against it and cut out the part of the picture that shows his wife Suzanne's face. Degas, who was presumably shocked, took the picture home and sent Manet's still life back to him with a note that read, "Sir, I am returning your plums." So why would Manet, this man whom everyone seemed to love, and who, as his friend Fantin Latour wrote, always approves of the paintings of people he likes, why would he do such a thing? Well, I have my ideas and I love to think about it. The fact is that in the end, I don't honestly know, and I don't think anyone ever will. But the picture is still there, as unknowable and as electrifying as ever. And that, for some reason, feels like a good point to turn this strange monologue over into a discussion.
That was fantastic. He would be a star in my class. It was just wonderful.
I'd be lucky to be.
Thank you so much. It was really so rich, so filled with thought. And perhaps we should begin maybe with that very mysterious portrait in Kitikushu, Japan, which if you've not been to, go. It has one of the greatest Monets, one of the great late Monets of all time.
It is beautiful, and it hangs in the same room.
It's a great dialogue. Because that painting, as you rightfully raise, Sebastian, is so mysterious, so inexplicable on so many levels that we could, of course, probably spend the entire evening here talking about what it may be. And to my mind, it sort of suggests one thing that you touch upon and place in great value, and that is the mystery of art, the ways in which we respond in some kind of intuitive, perhaps slightly informed way, by something that is in front of us. Let's narrow it down to a painting as opposed to a piece of sculpture, something like that. So could you talk just a little bit about that notion of intuition as you stand in front of a picture like that?
Well, I mean, the fact that this picture is in this museum in Kitakyushu, as you said, on the island of Kyushu, I was almost sort of intoxicated with anticipation. I wanted to get up close. I wanted to see things like the join where the canvas had been repaired by Degas, who did intend to repaint it, and that's why he repaired it, but never got around to it or decided against it. And that's why his signature is there on the bottom in the corner. But as I say, I was filled with sort of information and ideas about the picture, which I'd seen in reproduction many times. But what I wasn't prepared for was this shock of being in front of the actual thing. And I hadn't really noticed in reproductions, which probably hadn't been good enough, but I hadn't noticed the richness of this sort of turquoise coloring that spreads out around the figure of Suzanne Manet. The delicacy of Manet's shoe. He wears a sort of pointed leather shoe, which is beautifully
rendered. A pair of spats.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And a waistcoat, and he's looking very dapper, as Manet allegedly always did. And Suzanne, his wife, is there at the piano. As I say, we can't see her face, but she's wearing a blouse, which Degas, in a sort of amazing touch, has made transparent, except, of course, at the seams. And it's just a bravura touch that he sort of conveys the slight transparency of the blouse, but make sure to sort of indicate the seams where light doesn't get through. So there are all these things that I noticed about it, and I just had such a wonderful feeling in front of it that all the ideas I had about it kind of disappeared. And yet, and this is something I want to stress, that feeling, that sense of magic that we sometimes feel in front of works of art should hopefully open out onto a desire to know more. I've spent months subsequent to that visit finding out more and more and more about the picture and developing more and more ideas about it. But, you know, I value that face-to-face immediate experience enormously. But in me, it does trigger a desire to find out more. And I think that is a crucial part of what I was trying to say.
What I'm interested in, when I hear that very same phrase, I don't know much about art, but I know what I like, I concentrate on the second part.
Right.
You take the positive, because if they like something, they've already defined a certain set of criteria for what they believe is supposed to be a recognized work of art. It may be skill, as you said. It may have something to do with the ways in which paint is manipulated, or whatever it may be. And then, as an educator, and you as a critic, I'm sure you would agree, that you then build on that to be able to say, okay, let's define what you like.
Right.
And why do you like that? Because we all come to these things with our prejudices. It's just innately human. And if you can build on that to be able to then construct a kind of personality of liking things, then you can open that up. I always tell my students, when they go to a museum, don't just go to look at things that you like. You must take time to go to look at something you know nothing about or that you don't like at all, and spend as much time looking at some of those things as well, because it will, in fact, encourage you to perform the same function that you do, because you have that innate kind of appetite.
Well, it becomes a question then, I suppose, of how do you open it up? I think biography is often a great key into works of art. When you learn about the life of the artist and the social context, of course, and all these other aspects, it's a great way in. But it's not the only way in. And it's something that I think about often as, you know, I've got two young kids and I'm determined not to sort of put them off art for the rest of their lives by, you know, dragging them around museums, you know, so that they sort of grow up and say, oh, my dad was an art critic, it was a nightmare, I had to go to museums all the time. But I do take them when I can, and we have favorite museums and favorite places to go. And I'm always thinking about what's a good way in. And often the best way is just to let kids find their own way through.
Just like older kids.
Right, exactly. But there are so many different keys in, I think, right, to art.
So, but that also implies that actually knowing something having a few facts at your hand is indeed a good thing, not just to offset the ignorance, but to allow for an entry into this wonderful world.
I suppose what I worry about going to many museums and exhibitions today is, as I said, the preponderance of explanatory text and this feeling that you have that the institution that's put the show on is kind of falling over itself to edify and educate and civilize people who come to see these shows, as if that were the main point. And I frankly find it often patronizing and not to the point. It's as if everyone is afraid of talking about aesthetic experience. Now, I don't go around, you know, succumbing to Stendhal syndrome every time I'm in a museum. I'm not trying to give that impression that one stands before a work of art and swoons and so on. It's not like that at all. But it is important to hold on to the value of aesthetic experience. Just as when we go to a concert and listen to Beethoven, if we're sitting there reading the program notes through the concert, it's really beside the point, isn't it? I mean, it's not why we've gone to that concert. We've gone to listen. And I think that learning to look with your eyes is one of the things that, as a culture, even though we're living in such a visual culture where we're deluged with visual stimuli, learning to look at pictures is something that we haven't really focused on as much as perhaps we should. And, you know, I think that learning to read visually is different from learning to read words, and it's a skill that, is it a skill? I don't know. It's an ability that has often sort of fallen by the wayside, I think.
You know, works of art are based on relationships, internal relationships, relationships between the work and the moment in which it's made, relationships between the work and the artist, and relationship between the work and past art. But specifically in terms of learning to look, one of the best things to do is go slowly, but then begin to break it down into its individual components, because every picture is built upon the very essence of painting: line, color, shape, form, space, surface, materials. And if you simply have those little checkboxes and be able to look at a work itself, you can begin to see that the artist has constructed this. And every single touch on that canvas, if it isn't some kind of petit accident, it is going to be planned. It's going to be having a reason for being there, even if it is an accident. So one color speaks to another color. The light in one area speaks to the darkness. The twist of an arm speaks to the turn of a leg. So if it gets broken down into its individual details, those relationships will become meaningful and poetic. And I would simply add that if you don't like it, one, that's okay. But secondly, analyze why you don't like it. Break it down into those components so you can keep them within a certain kind of framework and perspective. And perhaps eventually they may intersect with other things that will indeed appeal to you.
Yeah. But yeah, not liking it is absolutely okay. And there is a lot of bad art out there. There's no denying it.
But you have to admit that there's something, that something's bothering you, and you have to get to the problem. Well, would you please join me in giving Sebastian a warm and appreciative applause.
Thank you for coming. And thank you all. Thank you so much.
It was great. You have been listening to a program of Cambridge Forum recorded in April 2014, co-sponsored by the Cambridge Arts Council and the Massachusetts Council Cultural Council. For information about this forum entitled Learning to Look, featuring Sebastian Smee, please visit us at cambridgeforum.org. In Harvard Square, I'm Paul Tucker. Thank you very much for joining us.